Again, it is a great delight for me to be with you for this special celebration that you have in these many years that God has had this church in existence, and I'm glad to be a part of it. Would you turn in your Bibles this morning to Jeremiah chapter 9? Let me just give you a little personal testimony that lies behind this passage. I grew up in a Christian home in South Dakota. Grew up on a cattle farm in South Dakota. My grandfather had about 3,000 acres and about 700 head of cattle, about that many sheep and a couple hundred hogs and a bunch of chickens. And my father hated farming, but he loved mechanics. And of course, on a farm that size, there was a lot of mechanical things to fix. And so Dad did all the mechanical work. And eventually, Mom and Dad left the farm, and it was a great, I'm glad growing up in that environment. Went to a one-room schoolhouse, 12 kids in 8 grades, and actually one of those schoolhouses that, there were 4 of them in neighboring townships that were built at the same time with square nails and everything, and one of the locals, when they were auctioned off, bought one and outfitted it with everything that was in it. So my children have been able to see where I went to school and what it was like, and they thought, Daddy, this is Little House on the Prairie. And I said, yeah, it was, except we had electricity. That was the only difference between those same kind of desks and outhouses and all of that. But we eventually moved in town, and Dad took a job working with a machine company in town in Sioux Falls, a larger town in South Dakota. And I grew up in a Christian home. Mom and Dad were believers. We were in a conservative Baptist church at that time, and I probably weren't well taught in a lot of areas, but Mom and Dad knew right from wrong, and they taught us right from wrong. But in my high school years, I rebelled against God and against my parents, and a lot of nights I didn't come home. I started a rock group in high school, against my parents' wishes, my pastor, and ran around a lot. I did a lot of stealing, got into pornography. My life was just a disaster. And Mom and Dad wanted me to go to a Christian college for a year. So in a weak moment, I promised them I'd do that. Let my guard down one time. So I was too proud to go back on my word, so I went to Bob Jones University to do my 1 year time in that maximum security facility. And then when I was paroled, I was going to go and do what I wanted. And God got a hold of my heart my freshman year and just turned me around. I remember standing on the front of the campus one night, really late at night, on the Bridge of Nations. It was about 10:15, and had to be back in the dorms at 10:30, but it was a starlit night, just clear. Nobody was around. And I was thinking, Jim Berg and Bob Jones, that's an oxymoron if there ever was one. You can't put those two in the same sentence. I thought, that's like Microsoft Works, you know, that's an oxymoron. You know, you can't put those two things together. But I thought, there's only one reason why I'm here and not in jail. There's a God in heaven that loves me. And you know what? That's the only reason why any of us are where we are right now. There's a God in heaven that loves us. And God did a lot in my heart that freshman year. And I heard somebody say, you're not ready to live until you know what you want written on your tombstone. Now, I'm kind of a simple guy. I went back to my desk, and I took a sheet of paper, and I drew a tombstone. I'm not an artist, nor the son of an artist, but I drew as best I could a tombstone. I laid that on my desk, and I thought, I got to know what I want written on that. And the whole point was, you've got to, as some have said today, you've got to start with the end in mind. If you don't know how you want it to end up, you won't know what decisions you ought to be making today to get there. And so I thought about that a long time. I don't know how many days that thing laid on my desk, but I went through the Bible in different passages and saying, Lord, what do I want written on that tombstone? How do I want this thing to end? One of the things that happened my freshman year was the premier of Flame in the Wind. How many of you have seen that film from BJ? All right, a bunch of you have. It's about the Spanish Inquisition and about these people burning at the stake for their faith in Christ. I remember sitting there, and God moved me greatly with that film. I remember sitting there watching these men and women burn at the stake. And I thought, you know, these men and women were willing to die for Jesus. I'm not even willing to live for him. And I went forward at the invitation after that film, and that's where my journey back to God really began. I was so far from God, I didn't know if I was saved. And I went forward and I said, God, I don't know if I'm saved or not. I'm so far from you, but if I am saved, please forgive me. If I'm not saved, I need to be saved. In either case, I'm coming home. And so I started looking for what I want written on that tombstone, and I looked a lot of passages. I finally came to this one, Jeremiah 9. 23 and 24. And I don't know what brought me to that. I know who brought me to that, but I don't know how I got to this passage. Verse 23 says, thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. God said, I'm not impressed with your wisdom. I plugged your brain in and I can unplug it. I'm not impressed with your might. I don't care how much you can bench press. I made the worlds. And I don't care. I'm not impressed with your riches. I'm the one who gave it to you, and I can take it away. But then in the next verse, he says, here's what I am impressed with. But let him that glorieth or boast, let him boast in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me. That I am the Lord, that exerciseth loving kindness, judgment and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. I thought I know what I want written on my tombstone. And I wrote on that piece of paper, here lies a man who knew God. I thought that God says this is the thing that's most important. And I thought I want to spend the rest of my life getting to know who God is. And I want to do that in such a way that when I die, I'm not saying this has to be in my tombstone, but that people would look back at my life and say, there was a guy who knew God. Well, if that's how I want to end up, then there are a lot of things that have to happen to get that way. And that means I got to spend a lot of time in this book. I got to get to know this God. And I thought, I need some help on that. I went up to the bookstore at Bob Jones and saw a couple of books on the shelf. I bought them. One was Knowing God by J.I. Packer. I don't know how many times I've read that book. It's been a great help to me through the years. The other one was by A.W. Tozer, The Knowledge of the Holy. God has used A.W. Tozer to disciple me like just about no other person. Sometimes, you know, it's kind of fashionable today to have a mentor. And when students come into my office, say, Dr. Berg, who is your mentor? And I point to my bookcase and I say, those are my mentors. You know, these guys, they're dead. All my mentors are dead. They were dead when they taught me. But they taught me through their books. And A.W. Tozer was one of those. I want to talk to you tonight, this morning and tonight about knowing God. If God says this is the thing that is the most important thing, that you know who I am, then we got to know what that means and how we get to know God. Well, when we ask it, and I'm just going to ask some questions this morning and answer those questions. The first question to ask is, what does it mean to know God? What does it mean to know God? We admire, when we go through the scriptures, we admire men who knew God. They seem to stand head and shoulders above everybody else. David was a man after God's own heart. Imagine, you know, in some businesses, there are parking spots for, you know, for the CEO and other important people. And they got a little tag up there and it says CEO or CFO or something. And imagine if your parking spot said, man who knows God. That's David's parking spot. Here's where a guy parks who knows God. He's a man after God's own heart. And let's say that that's your parking spot. Man after God's own heart. That was on your tag. Wouldn't that be amazing? That's what's on, you know, David parked his chariot, you know, one of those places that man after God's own heart. God put that title there. Or Abraham, who is called the friend of God. Imagine that your parking spot. Your parking spot has on it, friend of God. And God put it there. We admire these men, but they're made out of dust just like we are. They're sinners saved by grace just like we are. But they knew God. Well, knowing God is more than just knowing something about God, although you have to know something about God to really know God. You do have to know things about God. But you and I know that we can know a lot of things about people and not really know them. I think we know a lot of things about President Obama, but we don't, nobody really knows him. It's a kind of surprise. We really don't know who he is in a lot of ways. And you can know a lot of things about somebody and not really know them. Although you have to know things about people to know them. So it's more than just knowledge about God. It's more than just admiration for God. You can have admiration for God, and you can go to a worship service and appreciate a lot of things about God and not know him. Actually, what it means to know God is to have so many personal dealings with him that he's perfectly predictable to you and satisfying. You know, if you really know somebody, they're predictable to you. My wife and I have been married 40, we're on our 41st year. We had our 40th anniversary in May. You know, we're pretty predictable to each other. We can go into a restaurant, I know what she's going to order, and she knows what I'm going to order. You know, when your kids come up to you and say, Daddy, Mommy said this, and we would say, no, she didn't. You know, I know she wouldn't say that. You know, we're predictable to each other. When you know somebody well, they're predictable to you. I wonder, is God predictable to you? You know, we don't always know what kinds of things he's going to do in our life, but we ought to know always how he's going to be to us. He's always going to be a certain thing. God will always meet my genuine needs, always. God is always up to good, to something good in my life, always. God will always love me personally, always. I wonder if God's predictable to you. If you know him well, he is. You don't know how things are going to turn out down here, but you always know what God's going to be like as you go through that, if you know God well. And it means to have a lot of personal dealings with him. There's something going on between you and God if you know him. I love being in a college environment. I still think of myself as about 21-year-old in a 61-year-old body. My body reminds me that I'm not 21. You know, you might see this couple on campus. What's neat about, you know, young people is they get attracted to each other and they end up getting married and so forth. And you might turn to another, you might be walking along, going to a class and talking with another professor and say, you know, have you seen John and Mary? I think there's something going on between them. Just by the way they talk to each other and the way they look at each other, you know there's something going on. I wonder if the way people look at you and me and watch our lives, if they know there's something going on between us and God. I wonder, can your kids and your grandkids know that there's, can they just by watching see that there's something going on between you and God? If we know God, there should be something going on between us and God. Well, why is it important for us to know God? Well, because the most important thing about us is what we know to be true about God. I remember that phrase from A.W. Tozer's Knowledge of the Holy. It just stood out. It's on one of the first pages of the first chapter. He said, were we to extract from you your mental image of God, we could predict your life. I think that's true. If we had a screen up here and we could portray your picture of God that you have in your mind, we could predict a lot about you. We could tell how prone you are to worry just by what you know to be true about God. We could know how prone you are to give in to temptation, how prone you are to despair, how prone you are to get angry and bitter, all by what we know to be true, what we see about your knowledge of God. It's the most important thing about us because our beliefs about God determine our behaviors. They determine everything about us. Did you know that you and I are always acting consistently with what we know to be true about God? Always. Even if we're deceitful and lying, even when I was in rebellion, I was acting consistently what I knew to be true about God. I thought he didn't care. I'd heard some things, but I thought I could get by with things. I believed that about him. We act consistently with what we believe to be true about God. I think it's an interesting study in discipleship to go through, particularly the New Testament, and watch these different people and groups of people as they respond to Jesus Christ. I love watching Mary, the mother of Jesus. You know, that first wedding, that first miracle that he performed at that wedding in Canaan. And somebody from the wedding feast came up to Mary, and I'm not sure why they talked to her, but came up to Mary and said, we're out of wine. And you know what she does? She says, you need to go talk to my son. You know, she's acting consistently with what she knew to be true about him. And she goes to Jesus and tells him what they need, and he says, basically, why are you coming to me? She just ignores that. And she turns to the servants and says, you just do what he says. Just watch. You just do what he says. This woman knew who he was. And her actions are completely consistent with that. And you watch the disciples as their knowledge of Jesus matures. Jesus had a way. You know, Jesus does not, even today, Jesus does not give us the luxury of teaching us something and then not testing it. You know, those of you who are still in school, understand that your teachers don't just, you know, give you a lot of facts and then they don't test it. There are those miserable exams that come up. And, you know, Jesus does the same thing. He's always teaching us and he's always testing us. In fact, what you learn in the services today will be tested this week. What I learned from my Bible this week will be tested this week. Jesus is always doing that. He'd take those disciples after he performed a miracle or something. He'd take them out in a boat, shake that boat up real good in a storm, and they would. And he'd go to sleep, and then they'd wake him up in all panic and say, "Don't you care about anything? Don't you care about us?" And he would say to them, "Let's talk about your faith here. What do you really? Who do you believe I am anyway?" All of that's implied in his statements there. And then he would rebuke that sea, and they would just marvel. You know, at the beginning of their ministry with Jesus, there were those constant little flubs in their faith, in their trust in him. But boy, once he was raised from the dead, you look at how those men turned their world upside down after that Pentecost. They knew who this was. This was Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, the Messiah, who died and was raised again, and they turned their world upside down because they knew who he was. Our beliefs determine our behaviors. That's why it's important. Well, what does it require to know God? And I want to just take one thing and talk about it this morning. I'll take two more things and talk about it tonight. What does it require to know God? First of all, knowing God requires that we seek him. We seek him. Deuteronomy 4:29 says, thou shalt seek the Lord. Thou shalt seek the Lord. If thou shalt seek the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, thou shalt surely find him. God's not playing hide and seek where we just kind of finally get close to him and he runs away and says, "Na na 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 na, you can't find me." He's not playing that kind of game. But he doesn't just reveal himself to the casual passerby. You know, you and I don't. If I can say this reverently, you and I just don't spill our guts to everybody who comes along and asks us how we're doing. Now, there's some people that do that. You know, you say, "How are you doing?" And they give you this whole history of everything that's gone wrong in the last couple of days, and you almost wish you hadn't asked them how they were doing. But most of the time, we don't just spill everything to somebody who comes along. And we only really bare our souls to somebody that we know is committed to us and is going to take us seriously. And if I can say this reverently, God doesn't spill his guts either to somebody who's not going to take him seriously and isn't committed to him. You can't just do drive-by devotionals and expect to know God. You've got to spend some time in this word seeking for God. He says, thou shalt find him if you seek him with all of your heart and with all of your soul. During this time when I was pursuing this knowledge of God, as Jeremiah 9 kind of formed the direction of my life and pursuit and relationship with him, I remember coming to Proverbs chapter 2. You know, we hear James 1:5, how we get wisdom. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God to give it to all men liberally, and it braideth not, and it shall be given him. You know, that's fire extinguisher wisdom. That's not the normal way you get wisdom. That's what students do when we're in an exam. We say, "Lord, help me to remember these facts." Well, he's not going to help you remember anything you haven't studied. He's not going to just pull things out of the air, out of the ether, and allow you to put it on your... And you know, in those trials, those James 1 trials, God is not going to give you wisdom for anything in that trial that you haven't already studied out. The normal way to get wisdom is Proverbs 2. You seek for it as for hidden treasure. You go after it. You pursue it. You look for it. You look for this God in this book. Read Proverbs 2, 1 to 6. We don't have time this morning to do that. That's the way you get wisdom. And then in a trial, you can pray God to give you the wisdom you need to recall those things so you know how to respond right in a trial. But seeking God is that kind of a search. He said, you search for me with all of your heart and with all of your soul. It's not only, and so we could say that search for God is, first of all, a passionate search. It's a search for God himself. In this passionate way of, and when I say passion, I mean in this intense way, I've got to go to this Bible learning who this God is. I remember my freshman year after I got right with God, I'm not sure how, I mean, God did this. I was a rebel in heart. I was always a sneaky rebel. Not many people knew I was a rebel. Because I did everything sneakily. I didn't even sin with very many people. I didn't trust anybody. After my freshman year, or during my freshman year, I got asked to go on a ministry team at BJ. I have no idea how that happened, because I knew what was going on in my heart. But by the time that summer rolled around, God had really gotten a hold of my heart, and I was turning into a different kind of person. That summer, when I went out on that ministry team, I bought a brand new Bible, an Oxford leather bound. I'm not talking about bonded leather. I'm talking about genuine leather. Oxford Bible. By the end of that summer, it was worn out. I mean, the leather was worn out. The pages didn't stay in it. I knew that I was a fool. And I needed the wisdom of God, and I needed that Proverbs 2 kind of wisdom. And I remember every day opening my Bible and saying, God, I don't care what you show me in this book. You show it to me, and with your help, I'll do it. And that's that Proverbs 2 pursuit of wisdom of God. There can't be anything more important in our lives than knowing God. And we've got to pursue it. We've got to open our Bibles. I thought as a parent, the most important thing I can teach my kids is they've got to know God. And our daughters do know God. God's taken them through some rough times. Two of them are pastor's wives. That's not easy. One of them is a pastor's wife in downtown Chicago, 35th Street, South Chicago, White Sox territory, north of the stadium. I mean, they are in the hood. And four children there, right in the middle of this gang-infested area, and God, and carving out a work for God there. And you know what? You know what sustains her? She knows her God. The most important thing I can pass on to my kids is the knowledge of God. And my grandkids, I want them to know God. It's the most important thing they can know. Not only is it a passionate search, it's a purposeful search. He said, if you seek the Lord with all your heart. I remember one time a young man came into my office. I'll call him John, because that was his name. But John was a student leader on the campus, and a godly young man, a man that all of us respected. And he came in and said, Dr. Berg, I'm having trouble with my devotions. My heart is so cold, and I just need some help about that. He said, you know, I lead this extension ministry. He goes out and preaches and nursing home and some other things, and he was chaplain of his student society, and he was a room leader in the residence halls. And he said, I do all those things, but he said, I got a heart as cold as rock. I said, well, John, talk to me about what you do in your devotions. He said, well, I read my Bible and pray. Is that all right? I said, yeah, that's fine. That's what we do in our devotions. We read our Bibles and pray. I said, all right, now, when you read your Bible, when you open this book, what are you looking for? He said, well, I'll be honest with you, because I preach so much, I'm looking for sermon outlines a lot of the time. But he said, basically, I'm looking for things to get me through the day. And some principles for life. And I said, well, John, do you know why this book was given? He said, well, it was given for a guidebook for life. And I said, well, it certainly is that, but that's not why it was given. 1 John 5:9 says, this is a record which God hath testified of his Son. I said, John, everything about this Bible is a testimony of Jesus Christ. Everything here is about him. Dr. Paisley, one year from Belfast, North Ireland, he was preaching a Bible conference. He held up his Bible and he said, you can put your plow down on any page of this book and dig up Jesus Christ. Now, if that's true, why is it we can put our plow down in this book day after day after day and never see Jesus Christ? I think the answer is that we're not looking for him. We're looking for all kinds of other things. We're looking for things to get us through the day, and there's nothing wrong with that, but we're not looking for the person of God. And we're going to find what we're looking for. I mean, the amphitheater at BJ seats 6,000 people. I can sit on that platform when I was dean of students and look out there, and I can when they would switch chapel seats, and within just a few seconds, I could see my daughters. Why? Because I was looking for them out of that sea of people. I mean, the other students, I never even knew if they came to chapel or not. I mean, they were there, but I never saw them because I wasn't looking for them. But I was looking for my daughters. I want you to turn to Luke chapter 24. Let me leave you with this thought. And we'll pick up this tonight. In Luke chapter 24. So after Jesus' resurrection, the women had been at the tomb and found it empty, came back and told the disciples. And they were all wondering about these things. And these disciples, a couple of them, are heading on this road that's going to a little town of Emmaus. And as they're walking along, Jesus joins them, only they don't know who he is. He's made it so they physically can't see who he is, or he's shielded his identity from them in some way. And he asked them, basically, why are you guys so sad today? And they said, you must be new in town. Don't you know what's going on? And he said, well, tell me what's going on. And they said, well, we thought Jesus was a Messiah and that he was going to be the deliverer of Israel. And he's been crucified. And some of the women of our band have testified that he's risen from the dead. And we just don't know what to think about these things. Well, then look at verse 25. Then he said unto them, O fools, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Ought not Christ or Messiah to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? And beginning at Moses and all the scriptures, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning the eschatological implications of the kingdom. Is that what that says? He's going to expound the things concerning himself. And you know, later on, when Jesus left their midst after they ate lunch with him together, Subway or something, verse 32, and they said one to another, did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us by the way and while he opened to us the scriptures? And what was he showing them in the scriptures? He was showing himself. That's why A.W. Tozer calls this the fellowship of the burning heart. The people who are looking for God. And they're finding him because they're looking for a person. You know, this Bible has a lot of wonderful principles. Let me illustrate this, though. The farmhouse, when I was growing up on this farm, we lived in the central farmhouse. There is no farmhouse on that property. And my grandparents had built a little ranch house about a quarter of a mile down the road. And in the afternoons, particularly in the summertime, about mid-afternoon, we boys, it was just kind of like clockwork. We would remember, oh, we got to get down to Grandma's. We'd run into the house, say, Mom, we're going to Grandma's. And we would get on our bicycles, or we would run down there, a quarter mile down that gravel road. And we'd run into the house and say, Grandma, we're here. And she knew what for, her chocolate chip cookies. And she's Norwegian, you know, as they talk like this. And say, Grandma, you got any cookies? She says, yeah, I've got some cookies. And she'd get these chocolate chip cookies out, and she kept them in these. Remember when coffee used to come in these tin cans, and they had that little thing, key on the top, and she'd put all those chocolate chip cookies in those tins and put them in the freezer. They're nothing better than my grandmother's chocolate chip frozen cookies with some milk. And she'd pour some milk, and we'd eat those cookies. We'd devour two or three of them and drink the milk. And then we'd run out and play in her swing set because Grandma's swing set was better than our swing set. It had a glider and some bars and all this kind of stuff. And ours were just swings. So we'd play in that a little while, and then we'd run back home. Now, when my daughters were young, we made two trips to South Dakota so they could meet my grandmother and meet some of the relatives there when she was still living. And let's say that this didn't happen this way, but let's say that we drove up to Grandma's. We drove the 1,350 miles from South Carolina to South Dakota. And we get out of that car and run in the house. And I say, Grandma, we're here. You know, and we hug and everything. I say, Grandma, now my girls have never tasted your cookies. Do you have any chocolate chip cookies? Yeah, we've got some cookies. And she'd get out the cookies and put them on a plate. And And then when we got done eating, I'd say, girls, aren't these just what I told you? I mean, there aren't any better chocolate chip cookies in the world. Now, let's get back in the car because we got to go see Mount Rushmore on the other side of the state. And Grandma, it's good to see you again. It's been many years, and maybe sometime we can see you again. Bye. And we head off, and my grandmother would scratch her head, and she would say, much learning hath made him mad. Something wrong with this boy. Now, what's wrong with this boy is that when you're 18, it's okay to go to your when you're 8 years old, it's okay to go to your grandmother's for her cookies. But when you're 38 and 48, you need to be going to your grandmother's for your grandmother. Now, folks, God has put a lot of cookies, a lot of wonderful promises, a lot of principles in this book. But did you know that you can eat those cookies and run right by God? You know, in the latter years of my grandmother, when I talked with her on the phone before she went to be with the Lord, I'd say, Grandma, you know, there are a lot of things I remember about you. But one of the favorite is I remember all those chocolate chip cookies. And I remember, you know, there are a lot of grandmothers probably don't even pay attention to their kids, but your grandkids, but you did. You were always thinking about us a lot of different ways. And I just appreciate you being that kind of person. You know, we need to be going to God. I mean, there are a lot of wonderful cookies in here he wants us to eat that he's baked for us, and they're phenomenal. But boy, when you come across one of those, you need to stop right there and talk to God about his cookies. And what kind of God would even do that, would put those there? We'll talk about that tonight. I want us to see that we've got to go looking for God in this book. And then we have to respond to him in a certain way, and I'm going to talk about that tonight. So the first thing I want you to get in this service this morning is that if we want to know God, we're going to have to seek for God. And tonight we're going to learn that we have to respond to him in a certain way if we're going to know him. You know, these young couples at the college, they get together and they start asking each other a lot of questions. Where are you from? You know, what's your favorite hobby? What do you do? What's your favorite color? Is your daddy rich? You know, all those important questions. And they're trying to find out something about that person. Well, you know, if you're going to know God, you've got to find out some things about him. You've got to go to this Bible looking for God. And that's the first thing. He says in Deuteronomy 4:29, if you will seek me, you will surely find me. If you seek me with all of your heart, with all of your soul. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you that you've not just kept yourself in heaven without letting us know who you are. You've given us this wonderful book. And in it, you've shown us your love and your compassion. You've shown us your grace and your mercy. You've shown us your justice. You've shown us your power, your wisdom. You've shown us your righteousness, all of these wonderful things about you. And Father, we confess that we don't even begin to know who you are, but what we know, we're impressed with. And I pray that we would become a people that would be pursuing the knowledge of you even more. I pray that as we seek you, you would do as you say, and you would reveal yourself to us when we seek you with all of our heart, with all of our soul. Thank you for this revelation of yourself in this book. Thank you that in this country we still have the freedom to preach it and to read it and to love it and to memorize it and to meditate upon it and to study it. And I pray that we would become people of this book. I pray that you would bless in our fellowship time together. We thank you that you've collected us together as a body. You've put us in the same body and with the same head, your dear son. And we pray these things in his precious name.